couple of announcements before we start. I can't remember. One of you, might have been Chase, asked if I would announce when there are ecology-related lectures on campus. This week, the Ecology Center is sponsoring Jordi Bascompte, who is a professor of ecology from Spain. And he is giving two lectures. One is Wednesday night at 6 o'clock p.m. in NR 105. And then the second one is on Thursday at 3 p.m. And both of his lectures have to do with what he calls ecological networks, or how one would conceptualize linking different types of ecological interactions. And his area of expertise is in mutualisms. So the way that these Ecology Center seminars work is the Wednesday night one is more for a general audience. And it's supposed to be exciting and interesting. And apparently this guy tells jokes and juggles when he gives his lectures. And then the more detailed science is on Thursday. In the evening, on Wednesday, after the lectures, they have a reception that you can go to if you want and meet that speaker. And then Thursday, before the lecture, in the atrium of NR, they have snacks and stuff, so you can go get snacks. So that's one announcement. And then I found a couple of job ads that are kind of local. There's two openings at Hiram State Park for maintenance people. So if you're interested in that type of work and it's local, might be nice. I'll post these on the class website too. So that one pays $9 an hour. There is one, this one's not really that local. There's two job openings for fisheries technicians. One is in Saratoga, Wyoming, and the other one's in Steamboat Springs. They're temporary positions with the Forest Service. And they give you housing and pretty good pay. So I'll post that on the website. And then this one is for a wildlife technician, fisheries type, based out of Ogden with the Forest Service. So that one goes for the summer also. So I'll post these on the class website. I'm going to hand out your exams, your graded exams. And then Thursday I should have your case study assignments done. The scores range from 100% to about 30%, and the average was 90. And there have been questions about how I do the final grading for the class. I automatically drop the score that's the lowest of the first three exams. And I do that after this exam. So, Matt Archibald. He did really well. Cody Allen. Michael Bales. Daniel Cadmus. I tried to sort of alphabetize him. John Ballantyne. Kate Cutler. Delia is not here. Jenny Christensen. Dijanae Diaz. Oh, there's Jenny. Justin Elsner. Shaylin. Mikkel, Craig Fackerel, Richie Gardner, Samuel Hill. Kevin Johnson. Jameson Jukes. Tren Hagman. This one is yours. Craig Kelson. Juan Bin Lin. Not here. Bryce Lindley. Evan Little. Chase Morgan. Shannon Moore. Dustin Mitchell. There you are. Kyler Mahoney. Oops. Did I take you to the wrong one? No. Thomas Maples. I see him over there. Brody Mon. John Owen. Michael Frisby. Lance Flieger. He never comes to class, that kid. Jared Randall. Yeah, I have all of his papers for the whole semester up there. Nate Stetler. Jacob Stoller. Dennis Shumway. Ryan Thompson. Andrew Thane. Lamar Watts is not here. Drew Ann White. Not here. Brian Watt. Hope Walters. So let me get Lance's papers. If you have questions about your standing in the class, my office hours are tomorrow from 11 till 1. And I can tell you things like how many points you need on the final to get a certain grade and that kind of stuff. And I don't have the rest of Lance's papers. They're on my table at my office. So did anybody come in late who didn't get their exam? Are you Chase? Thomas? Not Lamar. Kevin Johnson. I didn't. Anybody not get a case study assignment last Tuesday? Okay. Oh, you didn't? Okay, so on Tuesday we were talking about what limits primary production. And talked about how nitrogen primary production, net primary production, is usually nitrogen limited. Fresh water Ecosystems like lakes and streams are often phosphorus limited. Except out here in the west, where they're usually nitrogen limited. Net primary production. And oceans are nitrogen limited, except in some areas where they're iron limited. Fe is the chemical symbol for iron. And I talked about a bunch of iron enrichment experiments that were kind of sold to the federal government for funding in terms of how to ameliorate excess carbon dioxide. And Evan asked after class, well, why would they want carbon to go in the bottom of the ocean? And that's a really good question, because that reservoir, the residence time, is only on the order of 1,000 years. Maybe 4,000 years at the most. So it's a temporary fix. But I was talking about this guy named Michael Merkles, who was a graduate student at MIT. And this is totally an aside, but it's something to think about as policies start to be implemented in response to awareness that anthropogenic emissions of CO2 are leading to climate changes. And that is that this guy, Michael Merkles, bought the fishing rights to areas around the Marshall Islands in the South Pacific and has a patent on fertilizing offshore fisheries with iron. And then he's going to say that he can use that for carbon trading, where if he sucks up a certain amount of CO2 by stimulating the phytoplankton, then he can sell that to somebody that's emitting CO2. So we'll have to be voting on these kinds of issues in the next decade or so. So it's interesting to think about it. The lab estimates for this process of sinking carbon dioxide through stimulating algae with iron show that only about 100 tons are going to sink below the thermocline and get into the longer-term reservoir. So that's a little bit of an introduction to what limits primary productivity. When we were talking about community structure in the last unit, we learned about trophic cascades. And trophic interactions can also affect primary productivity. So these kinds of ideas would be bottom-up control of primary productivity, nutrient availability. The trophic cascade hypothesis was actually introduced in lake food webs, where they're interested in understanding how piscivorous fish, or fish-eating fish, how those interactions would translate to the rest of the food web. And they hypothesized that these piscivorous fish, these top predators, would have an effect on rates of primary productivity in the lake, so on this lower trophic level here, the phytoplankton. And they did some really interesting experimental manipulations in lakes where they reduced the piscivorous fish, and that increased the planktivore biomass. And those decreased herbivores then resulted in increased phytoplankton. So if we go back to this food web here, we have the bass, and then we have the piscivores, or planktivores. And then we have herbivores. Ew. And then we have the phytoplankton. So based on what you remember from your case study about the moose and the fur and the... This thing's wet. It's weird. If we eliminate bass, how do you think that should affect the phytoplankton? So we decrease the bass. What's going to happen to the planktivores? They should go up. And if they go up, these should go down. And so we should have an increase in primary net primary productivity if there's a trophic cascade. If we have a food web where there are no bass and they're introduced to a lake, then we might expect a decrease in the planktivores, an increase in the herbivores, and a decrease in primary productivity. And so this hypothesis then was tested using some experimental procedures of whole lakes. And this cartoon just shows what happened. So up here they're reducing the bass biomass, and here they're doing introductions of bass in a lake that previously didn't have those. And they showed that in the one where you decrease the bass, you do get a trophic cascade where the phytoplankton biomass increases and so does primary production. And similarly, if you do an introduction of bass to a lake that previously doesn't have them, then you get a decline in net primary production. How do you do an experiment like this without completely destroying the natural ecosystem? Well, you do destroy the natural ecosystem. Shaylin had a question.
Now, if you're adding in the bass to this lake, why wouldn't they also consume the herbivores?
Why wouldn't the bass also consume the herbivores? I guess in this particular food web, they were more predaceous on the smaller fish, as opposed to the herbivores. John had a question?
I was thinking something similar to what he said about the previous example of sinking the carbon by increasing the algae.
Mm-hmm.
That seems pretty dangerous because we don't have any idea what the effect of that would be.
Right.
It was saying global climate is a really good sense of things by saying they did that on a big scale. Or vice versa.
Right. Well, they have studied some of the effects of these kinds of things. Like the ocean experiments, they tend to stimulate algae that are more of the rare taxa that are found, and some of them are not palatable to the herbivores, and some of them actually produce toxins. And some of them also produce this chemical compound called DMS, dimethyl sulfide. That's the smell that you get when you're by the coast. And that DMS actually, when it volatilizes into the atmosphere, it forms kind of a cloud seeding chemical, and so you get higher cloud cover. Yeah. So those are some of the indirect effects. Yes. This area where they've been studying this is part of a long-term ecological research site, which has like 10,000 little lakes. And so they'll do things like put a curtain in the lake and then remove the fish from one side, stick them on the other side, or add fish to a small lake that doesn't have fish. That's how they did that.
For me, to tie this in with like the last step, richness of species. When you do stuff like this, don't you mess with that, like how diverse that community is?
Yeah, so the question is how does that affect the diversity? And that's part of the issue of what I mentioned on Tuesday is experiments at this level, the people that, this was done in the 1980s, and at that time people were putting organisms in black boxes and not really even considering who was in the box. They just said plankton. And so now they're having a greater understanding of what taxa are involved and taxa shifts, and there is definitely a change in the structure of a lot of these communities. In particular, they've seen shifts in the size of the herbivore, going from either a large Daphnia to the smaller types of rotifers. And this type of cascade works really well in these lakes in Wisconsin because they had simple food webs, but in other kinds of systems it's not quite as clear cut, and it's because of these shifts in the community structure that go on. Other questions? Nowadays, to do these kinds of manipulative experiments, it's pretty much really difficult to get permission to do them. So a lot of the work on these large ecosystem manipulations was before you had to do NEPA type of ecological assessments to say what the benefits are and what the ecological costs could be. You got a question? You could do the kind of thing in a private lake. Well, and fisheries managers were interested in this kind of thing because they do introduce fish for sport fishing. And so they were interested to know what would happen if fish were introduced. Similar types of processes have been studied in terrestrial ecosystems in the context of particularly these large grazers. And in one study in Africa, they were interested in understanding what the wildebeest grazing would do. And the hypothesis was that grazing by this large herbivore would have a type of trophic cascade. Kind of in the context more of disturbance, though, by grazing, the hypothesis was that they're actually going to stimulate growth of the primary producers through some compensatory growth. And so they had some areas that they put up large fences so that the wildebeest couldn't access those plots of grass, and measured over time differences in biomass. And as I said on Tuesday, for measuring primary productivity in terrestrial environments is really difficult. So usually they use the harvesting technique where they just clip grass and weigh it as a proxy for that. And over time you can figure out how much is actually growing. So in the ungrazed enclosures, you can see there is a lot more biomass here in blue than in the grazed areas. But over time, the ungrazed areas actually decreased in biomass while these grazed areas increased. And the thought here is that, I mean, even after a month, they're almost the same. And the idea here is when there are no wildebeest grazing the grasses, eventually they become limited by light and the grass shades itself out. And so the grazing actually allows for compensatory growth by those terrestrial primary producers. And similar to the intermediate disturbance hypothesis, the areas that are grazed at an intermediate level have the highest primary productivity. Low grazing intensity has low production due to shading effects. And then these high grazing intensities is also associated with low production because of the plants just can't tolerate that much grazing. And you can certainly see this type of thing if you're driving around rangelands in the West, where some areas that have a lot of head of cattle tend to be more desertified looking than areas that are managed to move the cattle around. One thing that I mentioned on Tuesday was the work of Raymond Lindeman. And he was, one of his ideas was the reason for low biomass of predators has to do with energy transfer through food webs. And so what he did is he measured the biomass of phytoplankton, the biomass of herbivores, and the biomass of higher-level consumers. But he also put all of these organisms into what are called a bomb calorimeter and measured the energy content. And he measured the diet of the consumers and was able to figure out how much biomass they were consuming and then how much energy was in their biomass. And so he was able to show that at the lower trophic levels, so here's the primary producers, in two different lakes. Cedar Bog Lake is a low nutrient lake, and Lake Mendota is a lake just outside of Madison, Wisconsin, in the town of Madison, Wisconsin, that has a lot of nutrients, and so it has a higher rate of production. But you can see that the herbivore production is an order of magnitude less. So they lose almost 10 times as amount of energy as they're gaining. And then again, the third trophic level, there's less production. And then finally, at the fourth trophic level, it's so small that you can't even hardly see it. So what you get is this thing called a pyramid distribution of productivity, showing that not only do they decrease in numbers, but just in terms of the energy flow decreases, and that's why we only see four or five trophic levels in most ecosystems. So we talked about limits to primary productivity, and another aspect of energy in ecosystems is trying to understand these energy transfers through food webs. And this is just kind of how one might simplify the energy flow. And it doesn't look very simple, does it? But conceptually, we have these primary producers, and they are using energy from the sun or chemical energy to fix carbon into their biomass. Some of that stays into that box, but a lot of it is lost as respiration. So when we have the next level, this is just going to the herbivore, so now they're going to have about 10% of that energy that's available to them here goes into this box, where it can be lost due to predation, respiration, death. Feces and urine are all carbon compounds that are lost to the detritus pool. And detritus is dead organic matter. That can feed decomposer communities, but again, a lot of it's going to be lost due to respiration. This pool of detritus and the decomposer community is often separated from the higher trophic levels. Like in the trophic cascade food web, we saw nothing about decomposer communities. But they're going to be important for recycling nutrients to make them available for the primary producers again. Yes?
So I was just wondering, on each trophic level, as you go from the bottom up, you lose 90%?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yep.
That's interesting to me that they call it loss. And if you look at the thing overall, they're literally transferring back. You say it's loss in respiration, for example, in the primary. Well, they're producing oxygen with their respiration, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's used at another trophic level. It's then produced CO2. It's used in the primary.
Right, but it's loss in the sense that here's organic matter that represents the energy source for the next trophic level. So that energy that's available, some of it is basically burned off by the plants in order for the plants to grow, and they respire that energy source. So you're right, and then that CO2 that's respired eventually will become fixed again. But in terms of what's available to the next trophic level, there are these losses that make it unavailable. And so it's these losses that account for why going from here to here, there's only 10% of what's available here is available here. So this one is a more complicated type of diagram of energy flow in a forest ecosystem from your textbook. And the point here in all of these things is just to understand that there are huge losses of energy with trophic transfers. So solar energy is the primary source of energy. So it represents 100%. 12% of it goes into above ground biomass. Some of it's reflected as light. Some of it is given off as heat. Some of it drives evapotranspiration. And some of it is respired directly by the plants. So evapotranspiration is a huge energy loss in these terrestrial communities. So now we have above ground biomass. Not very much of it is stored. You can see these arrows are getting smaller and smaller. So these food webs that have all of the animals and stuff that we like to study really represent a very small portion of the energy that's cycling in the biosphere. Very little bit gets exported into, say, aquatic ecosystems. So the point here is that energy is limiting the food webs that are in the ecosphere. Humans have modified energy flow on the planet, though. And this is one diagram from an old textbook from the 1950s. But it basically shows here energy flow in, say, a forest ecosystem where we have the forest and herbivores and, say, a predator like a fox. But the energy that's available, say, for herbivores is about 2,000 kilojoules in this forest ecosystem. And one way that humans have modified energy flow is by increasing production of forage for humans through agricultural practices. And so that basically increases by fivefold primary productivity. And it goes to feed people. So fivefold increase in primary productivity, roughly. The way that we do that is primarily through energy subsidies that involve, so in here there he's taking how much fertilizer and pesticides are produced and how much that costs in terms of horsepower and how much that increases productivity. So here in India, this is in the 1980s, they didn't apply too much fertilizer and pesticides. The US and Japan applied quite a lot. But the point here is that in order to get a tenfold increase in productivity, you also require here a hundredfold increase in the energy input. Evan? Well, one thing that we'll get into probably next week is there's a relationship between primary productivity and time. So if you clear cut a forest, for example, at first net primary productivity is low, but it increases over time as the forest is growing. And then once those trees reach a kind of stable age, they're basically just maintaining themselves. And so primary productivity levels off. So when you convert a landscape that is already grown, it's just maintaining itself in terms of energy in and energy out. You get that kind of thing. So you cut this down and then grow more crops that then are harvested, and that kind of keeps it at this high rate of increase. John? Yeah. So that's what this graph is showing. So here's yield, a measure of productivity. Starting, India is around 1,000, Japan is a little less than 10,000, so that's 10 times higher productivity. India's horsepower to produce that yield is 0.1 per hectare. And in Japan, to make that, it's about 10, so that's a 100-fold increase. So Japan is spending 100 times more horsepower, basically, to get a 10 times increase in productivity.
Right here with your example of the time and that productivity, how that relates to each other, is that going to change? Like you say, if the forest is completely clear cut, it's going to be slow at first, and then it's going to get to like that stabilization point. But what about other things in there, like if you have, you know, deer, you got elk or whatever, other, you know, species that may be in there, will those affect that? Like over time it goes up at peak, but does that ever start coming back down in a natural environment?
The effect of grazing would be something like, you know, it would be
just kind of right there at that kind of the carrying capacity point where the where that forest can be.
Yep.
It's going to just stay kind of around the tree.
Mm-hmm. There, yeah, Shaylin.
I was just kind of curious about this example that you have before. Now, if you were to clear cut it, would you expect the graph to go above what it was before? Would it have a plateau?
So if you clear cut it and just let it go back, would it go up, and then what would the next?
Right, like if you waited 60, 70 years and you went back in, would you expect a higher plateau for that next clear cut?
So go something like this.
Yeah.
It would depend on what came back. If you let it just come back to what was native, you hypothesize that it should go back to this level, unless there was atmospheric deposition of nitrogen that would fertilize it. If you were planting specific types of forest trees, you know, they would differ. Yeah, we'll look at some examples of clear cuts later, maybe later today. The other aspect of how humans have modified energy flow on a global scale is summarized in a series of papers. One of them is by Peter Vitusik, who's an ecologist at Stanford. And in 1997, when his first paper came out, he had estimated that humans have affected 48% of global net primary productivity in a few different ways. About 20% or about 18% is lost because of humans. And by that, what they mean is converting productive land into parking lots and that type of thing. So it's not producing any kind of energy flow. A large portion is dominated by humans, and what he means here is landscapes that are planted for crops or used for grazing. So humans are dominating it, shifting communities from, say, a grassland to a soybean field or something like that. And only a small portion of that is actually used by humans for food, paper, building materials, and stuff like that. As of 2007, they've altered this so that it's more a little bit more than half is altered by humans. So now let's get into some nutrient cycling stuff. So as energy is flowing in ecosystems, materials are also cycled, and that's an important aspect of ecosystem ecology. So what I want to do is talk about what a nutrient cycle is, and we'll use carbon and nitrogen cycles as examples because they're in the news a lot lately. And we'll talk about what the components of the cycle are, so where these materials are, what organisms and processes drive changes in those, and then how humans have modified them. So here's a cartoon from your book of the modern day carbon cycle. And this is a common kind of way of depicting global nutrient cycles. So the arrows are going to be processes, and then pool sizes are going to be represented by these numbers. So if we'd make a cartoon of this on the board, that's a little bit easier to look at. Oceans are a fairly large reservoir, 38,000 gigatons. Where do you think most of the carbon is on the planet?
The atmosphere.
The atmosphere has a very small amount. Does anybody know what the... what forms of carbon are in the atmosphere? CO2. Methane. Some carbon monoxide sometimes. The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, does anybody know what it is? That's represented as a ton, gigaton, 720. When measured as a concentration, though, it's right now around 380 parts per million. And so the way that that is measured is that for every molecule, every million molecules of atmosphere, there's 380 molecules of CO2. One way to think about what a part per million is if we took a million cans of Coke, which would be about enough to fill up an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and wanted to know what one part per million was. If we took out one of those cans of Coke and put in Diet Coke, do you think you'd be able to taste the difference? No. And probably not if you took out 380 cans of Coke. So it's a very small concentration. Soils are estimated at around 1,500 gigatons on a global scale. And underlying all of these, the largest pool of carbon is in carbonate rock. So things like limestone. Vegetation is a fairly small pool, a little smaller than the atmosphere, 560. And then there is fossil fuels, like coal and oil. And what ecosystem ecologists do, this is a global scale type of depiction of where the carbon is, but we think about where is the carbon in our ecosystem if we're talking about a lake or if we're talking about the globe. You use a similar kind of process to conceptualize it. And to understand how carbon is moving around, it's useful to think about what forms it's in. You have inorganic forms and organic forms. So from here, from this kind of cartoon, what types of inorganic carbon do you think there are? What carbon here is inorganic?
Carbonate
rock. Right, carbonate rock. Fossil fuels are actually more, they're ancient organic carbon. Carbon dioxide as a gas, and then carbon dioxide in water forms ions like bicarbonate. And carbonate. They're dissolved in water. Plant biomass would be an organic form. How about in soils? What do you think's in soils? You have soil organic matter. You also have inorganic carbonates in soil. If you remember back from the beginning of the semester, there was a particular type of soil carbonate called caliche that's found in desert soils. That's basically calcium carbonate that's precipitated in it. If you dig in the soil and you see kind of a whitish substance, that's what that is. So there's inorganic carbon in the soil, too. You have some in the oceans and water. So those are primarily the types of carbon that's around. Methane is kind of an organic, sort of organic compound. So now that we have kind of an idea of organic versus inorganic, we can think about what processes are going to be involved in cycling carbon. So what is going to take carbon out of the atmosphere in inorganic form and put it into plant biomass? It's going from CO2 to plant. Photosynthesis, right. So we have photosynthesis going, making an arrow into the plant biomass and also into aquatic ecosystems. I'll just abbreviate that as P/S. How about the reverse? I heard somebody say respiration. Yeah, respiration in soils too. So if we look on this graph, or this cartoon, it's kind of hard to pick out the numbers. Soil respiration, well, they don't give you the rates here. It's about 60. Plant respiration, another 60. So on this graph, gross primary production is given as 120 gigatons. And that's balanced by respiration. So we have 60 coming from soils and 60 coming from the rest of the terrestrial atmosphere, the terrestrial biomes. We could also get CO2 coming out of rocks through volcanic activity. Thank you. And we can also have CO2 coming from combustion of fossil fuels. John? Mm-hmm. Yep. So they've got that here as a category of land use change. Would include natural fires. It would also include slash and burn type of fire, just general destruction of vegetation. Carbonate rock is formed over long geologic processes in the oceans through burial and diagenesis. So here's kind of a table that summarizes some of these fluxes. So where most of the carbon is, most of it is in rocks and the ocean. You can see 65 million times 10 to the 15th grams of carbon. And our land plants actually have the smallest amount. Notice that they don't even put carbon in anything other than plants. Just don't account for that much. Fossil fuel ranges from 5,000 to 10,000, like the pool size. It's hard to estimate how large this pool size is, but it's estimated between 5,000 and 10,000 times 10 to the 15 grams of carbon. So these are the fluxes of carbon. These are the arrows on this diagram. The oceans take up a small amount through dissolution of carbon dioxide. Photosynthesis and respiration are pretty much balanced at a global scale. Fossil fuels, this is the best known flux because we know how many barrels of oil there are and stuff like that. There's an economic tie to that. And then this land use change is fairly small and it's not very well estimated. So how has the carbon cycle changed? Well, as I showed you in the beginning of the class this semester, there's concern about this type of data where carbon dioxide concentrations over the last, in this case, this is just showing the last century and a half. Showing carbon dioxide concentrations. These are directly measured from a station in Mauna Loa, Hawaii. And you can see it goes up and down as the northern hemisphere growing season comes on. It sucks, the plants suck out some CO2, and then that's released when they're no longer photosynthesizing in the winter. It's extended back using ice core data. Here's a picture of an ice core. Here's the Industrial Revolution time. Some interesting things that you can see in these kinds of data too are here where there's this decrease associated with World War I and the flu epidemics and stuff like that. 1920s, where economic prosperity was pretty good in the industrialized world, CO2 emissions go up a little bit. So is the CO2 really increasing? This is from the fourth International Panel on Climate Change report. They just have a new report that extends this data to 600,000 years. But CO2 is given here in blue. Here's our current level. Here's the level in the 1800s, and then back through the last ice age, here's what the CO2 concentrations were. So right now we're higher than we have been, and that goes, this kind of pattern extends like this throughout the last several ice ages. But CO2 levels have been higher than that in geologic history of the Earth. You have a question, John? CO2. If people are not out, you know, if there's an economic downturn. Yeah. This graph is using a model that calculates CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere from the deposition of volcanic rocks. So when you have volcanic activity, you have formation of volcanic rocks, deposition of rocks, but you also have emissions of CO2. And so this graph shows current concentrations are around 380, so we're right around here. And you can see the blue line is deriving carbon dioxide concentrations from the formation rate of volcanic rock, which is in red. And you can see that when we have large episodes of volcanic activity, CO2 concentrations here during the Devonian were 4,000 parts per million, so 10 times higher than they are today. Does anybody know biologically what was going on in the Devonian? The first land plants are observed in the fossil record from Devonian strata. So here's when the C3 plants evolved. And remember, C3 plants have Rubisco as their primary carbon-fixing enzyme, and it's not very efficient with regards to turning carbon dioxide into organic matter. The Carboniferous age is the age when a lot of the coal formations were formed. It was a time when there were land plants and swampy environments that had low decomposition rates. In human history, you know, we're around here. So the point here is that in Earth's history, the atmosphere was different than it is today. It had higher CO2. But it also had a lot of different life forms that aren't here. Volcanoes do emit large amounts of CO2. This graph is coming from Southern California, up near, I can't remember the ski area. Mammoth, yeah. So Mammoth, this is an area where there's CO2. This is an old volcano, and there's CO2 that's kind of exuding out of the rock. And the concentrations of CO2 are around 1,000 parts per million in this area, and you can see that it's killing off the forest. So people look at this kind of thing and say, well, yeah, volcanoes do emit large amounts of CO2. And the plants that live here now are not necessarily going to do very well as a result of that. There's actually a cool story of volcanic activity and CO2 and human populations in Lake Nyos, which is in Cameroon. And Lake Nyos is in a volcanically active basin, and the lake doesn't turn over, so it's stratified. And the bottom of the lake receives excessive amounts of CO2. And in one kind of freak turnover event, the lake mixed, and a lot of CO2 came out of the lake, and people actually died because of this huge influx of CO2 that came about in just a freak turnover event of the lake. In terms of fossil fuel emissions, that's the concern in the news these days. Here's the total world emissions from 15 years ago when the fourth climate change report came out. The developed world was emitting 73%, and the developing world was emitting the rest. The USA, as a single nation, was dominating CO2 emissions. The concern now is that China, as its economic prosperity grows, is going to be emitting a considerable amount more. So if we think about changes in atmospheric CO2 that we're observing now, how might these fluxes of carbon be related to that? Well, one idea is fossil fuel combustion and biomass burning are causing these kinds of things. And like I said, this fossil fuel combustion is the best known because there's the economic tie to it, so we know how much a barrel of oil costs, for example, and how much is consumed. From the Mauna Loa data, the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration is increasing about 3 times 10 to the 15 grams per year. So what an ecosystem ecologist would do would say, well, how is that happening? So what you do is you say, okay, we have this net change of 3. It has to be due to either a change in input or a change in output. So we take 3 and we add up the inputs. This is respiration, fossil fuel, and land use change, and add up the outputs. This is ocean uptake, sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere, and photosynthesis. If you do the math, this equals 5.2. But we're only observing a change of 3. So what do you think that means? Either we don't know the fluxes very well, we don't know how much photosynthesis and respiration are going on, or we're really not burning as much fossil fuel or converting as much land, or we have these outputs wrong. There's a missing sink. So when you hear in the news about the missing carbon sink, that's what they're talking about. These inputs and outputs come up to 5, but the net change that we're observing is only 3. So we're not accounting for almost half of the carbon dioxide that should be emitted to the atmosphere. Yeah, it depends on the physiology of the plants. And also other gases that are coming out too, probably. So the point here is that we don't understand the global carbon cycle very well. There's a missing sink. And so what this missing sink has stimulated a lot of research to try and figure out what that sink is among ecologists and atmospheric scientists and that type of thing. But when policymakers see this kind of thing, they say, hey, there's got to be some kind of way that carbon from the atmosphere is being sequestered that we don't know what it is, and can we capitalize on that in order to ameliorate some of the increases that we've seen? So that's where the idea of pumping carbon into the ocean comes into play and stuff like that. So one aspect is, do we not have a good handle on the abiotic controls of carbon sequestration? Do we not know very well how fast carbonate rocks are being formed? So that's an area of research. The way that carbon rock is formed comes from weathering and diagenesis, which is rock, the geological term for rock formation, but basically you have ions like calcium and bicarbonate, which are in the ocean, entering deep waters and going through this diagenesis process where here's calcium carbonate rock being formed, and over time as this is buried, you get that rock formation. So an area of research is, well, do we not have a good idea of how fast that process is going? Another idea is, well, maybe the oceans are a missing sink. So maybe we don't have a good idea of what this flux is. So you do get photosynthesis taking up carbon dioxide and producing phytoplankton, but much of that carbon is then recycled back through respiration. But prior to the 1990s, the only way that ocean primary production had been measured was using little bottle experiments where they would go around in these long cruises and collect water and measure chlorophyll concentration, or they would measure photosynthesis in bottles. So that gives a spotty record of primary production, and scaling from, say, a 100 milliliter beaker to, you know, 80% of the globe surface is kind of a very large extrapolation. So in 2000 and 2001, a couple of interesting articles came out in Science Magazine where they're using this satellite called SeaWIFS to get global pictures of the ocean, hoping that that would represent the missing sink. And it turns out they got better numbers, but it's not accounting for the missing sink. Other possible sinks that are being studied include terrestrial ecosystems like the northeast temperate forests of North America. These are forests that are aggrading. They're regenerating after having been clear cut when the colonists came, and so maybe those forests are actually storing more carbon than previously thought. Soil organic carbon is really poorly understood. So this estimate comes from taking soil cores, which, you know, might be a meter long and this wide, and extrapolating to entire surfaces. Other aspects are in aquatic systems, lakes and reservoirs, looking for missing carbon there, especially in terms of buried wood and stuff like that. And then there was an interesting article about snow algae. You know, the pink algae, pink stuff that you see on snow, especially in the spring. Those are algae, and they're actually photosynthesizing. Turns out they're not accounting for the missing sink either. Yeah, John.
It takes something huge to account for that much, like something like photosynthesis going on way faster than respiration.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's why they're looking hard at terrestrial environments and how fast carbon is being laid into the soils, because that's a really poorly understood thing. Because most primary production estimates from the 1950s were based on harvesting surface biomass. So now they're looking at root biomass and root production and deposition in the soil. A couple years ago, I had a kid in class who said, well, what about animals? Can animals represent the missing carbon sink? And in particular, he asked the question, could the rise in obesity in the United States account for the missing carbon sink? So I said, well, I don't know. I'll give you 25 points if you do a little report for class. So he went through the primary literature and figured out on average how much weight the average American has gained above normal ranges and turned that into carbon. And it turned out to be like 0.001 gigatons of carbon. So it's not the missing carbon sink. So this is an active area of research in ecology right now. I think I'll stop today, and we'll do the nitrogen cycle on Tuesday because it gets kind of more complicated.